what we do today limits what we can imagine for tomorrow. And you see it in brainstorms all the time. People are asked to dream big. They find it really hard. I'm sure you've seen this in your work as well. So this idea of, you know, think outside the box, sometimes it's hard to see the box.
My name is Yaniv Korem. I'm here to study successful innovation professionals and uncover the mindset and models they use to de-risk the future. On this podcast, I invite fellow professors, practitioners, and entrepreneurs to have an honest conversation about the business of innovation. No more bullshit. We talk openly and honestly about what works and what doesn't. So come on, get your ass in that seat. School's about to start. Elvin, welcome back to school.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's a delight to have you. I've been waiting for this for a long, long time, but I think the wait is finally over and you're here. So I've got a whole bunch of questions for you. Are you ready?
Great. I'm really ready. Looking forward to the first one.
All right. So obviously the first one is going to be about your new book called Be Less Zombie. And it's your first book, I'm not mistaken, right?
That's right, yes.
Okay. I read it. It's fantastic. I loved it. I also think you should be charging a whole lot more for it.
Talk to my publisher.
I will. Just give me their email. I think you packed so much value into that book. It would have made for like two or three additional books, I think. But good for you.
Thank you.
What made you write the book?
Well, I never really intended to write a book. I actually started out, my career was in writing. I was a ghostwriter for execs, doing corporate speeches, some politicians, and ghostwriting articles and things. So I kind of knew how to write, but that was a very long time ago. And I never really intended to write a book. But what I found was happening was very often I would go into an organization and meet with the leaders, and typically they would say something like, listen, don't tell us why we need to innovate, don't tell us what we need to innovate, just tell us how. It's the how that is the problem. It keeps slipping through our fingers. This stuff feels like black box, it feels like it's dark arts, you know, how do you do this thing? And to begin with, I was a little bit puzzled, because even though this was my job and helping organizations to do this, I was thinking, well, it's not as if there aren't 1,000 innovation books out there. There aren't some really great courses and things out there. But what I realized, as I was developing in my innovation career was, one, yeah, there might be some great books out there, but no one's got time to read them. And two, whilst they are generally good, and I've got some excellent innovation books, they aren't perhaps as actionable and as practical as they need to be, so that when I've read chapter 17, I know exactly what I'm going to do next. You're kind of left with an idea and think, well, yeah, now what? And so I came to a point where I'd run a program. It was in its fourth year. I was working with emerging leaders for a record company. And we did this 1 week boot camp where you're training people in innovation techniques, and they go off for 3 months and run an experiment. And I thought, I just need to put something in these people's hands that gives them enough so that when I'm not around, other innovation experts aren't around, they've got something to lean back on, which is practical. They can switch on. It's not full of jargon. And it was kind of the book was born out of the desire to want to leave people with a resource that can be very practical and like the how manual, I guess.
What were you thinking, or how were you thinking about people using it when you were writing it? Was it like supposed to be a book that you read one time, you put it on the shelf or on your coffee table, or was it meant to be, you know, as a guidebook, something that you refer to ever so often?
Definitely the latter. I know what it's like. You know, we've all been on training courses and you remember it in the moment, but you know, then we forget 90% very quickly. And I wanted it to be kind of like a field guide, so that when I have that pitch meeting with that stakeholder, oh, what was that in chapter 17 or whatever it was again, and I can go back and pull it out and it's there and there's the template. And I wanted it to be something that people could almost treat like that. You use it just in time, as well as thinking strategically about innovation and its wider sense. So I guess it's interesting, this last week, two people have sent me pictures of them their copy of the book, which, and it's only been out a few months, but it's well thumbed, post-it notes all over it. And I'm thinking, phew, people are really using it what I hoped they would. So I'm really hopeful that that's gonna be the case with everybody, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw those pictures on LinkedIn. I thought they were fabulous. And I think it's an important takeaway or tip for our listeners is that you don't have to, if this is one of these books that you don't have to read from cover to cover. You can just basically skip around or just kind of land on that chapter that is really of interest to you at that specific point in time. And then, you know, refer to it or refer back to it when you need it.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I'm really hoping that will happen with this.
Yeah, so definitely we're going to put a link to the book and everything. We'll talk about this at the end and put in the show notes so people can buy it. But I want to talk about the research that you did for this book, because it's evident that while you were doing this research, you went to a lot of companies and you got to sort of peek under the hood. I'm curious, what did you find there and what surprised you the most?
Well, a few things actually. And even though I'd been working in the field for a while, when I decided to turn my focus on specific research angles, it was interesting what came up. I guess the first thing was, often I'd go into an organization and after the exec had said, "Don't tell me why, don't tell me what, just tell me how," the next thing that they would say would be, "We need more innovation. It's just not showing up." And I learned very quickly that's not true. When I asked the question, "Okay, so there's no innovation going on at all in any team?" Well, actually, now you come to mention it, there's a lot of innovation going on. What I really mean is there are no big ideas. I go to the big idea cupboard and it's empty. And the real desire was for a different portfolio of innovation coming through. It's more bolder ideas, because everybody knows, you know, you bet big, you win big. And there was a desire for more ideas that could potentially deliver high levels of competitive advantage and profitability, rather than the continual incremental stuff, which keeps us in the game, but ultimately suffocates us because we're so focused on becoming great at what we do, which is important, but it takes our eye off the longer term, the bolder ideas, the changes that will come that we end up not being prepared for. So that was the first one. The second was I'd always known that business as usual is a powerful force, but just the pure power of the status quo and its ability to crush innovation when I was getting up close and interviewing people at all levels inside the organization. And then I had this wonderful moment where I put the words "be less zombie" into one of those anagram generators on the internet just to see what would come up. And the first thing that appeared was "blob seizes me." And I thought, hey, that's exactly what's going on. It's the blob of the status quo grabbing hold of ideas and just squashing them before they could arise. Again, not a big surprise, but it was alarming really to see how prolific that was in almost every industry. And I guess the final thing is interesting, because when I ask an organization about this, they generally deny it exists. And that is an underlying culture of fear at various different levels. And I started to talk about this in the book in two ways. What I observed was, at one level, creative constipation, which is people, they do have bold ideas, but they are too afraid to let them out. And there's a couple of reasons. One is, I'm going to look stupid if I propose this and challenge the status quo in this way, and that's not good for my career. And the second level was, even if I do dare to propose this idea and my boss says yes, I've just given myself a night job, an evening job, because there's no time to do this. And I don't want to do that. It's not worth my while. So you've got this creative constipation at one end, holding in the ideas that the future actually needs from us. And then you've got creative indigestion, which is, even if those ideas do emerge, generally the system can't handle an idea that has no budget, no team, no real way of understanding whether it's even a good idea to pursue. So it can't digest it and eventually gets spat out of the system. So underneath all of that, I saw fear showing up in different levels that's really repressing the ability to innovate. And when I went inside organizations where this was less true, there was just one simple thing that stood out that helped all of these things become less powerful. And that was they simply chose that they were going to be great at innovation, because innovation is an argument with the status quo. And they recognized that even though we're going to be wrong a lot, even though we're going to make mistakes, even though it's going to be messy, we have no choice. The future is going to show up. And are we going to be ready, or are we going to be caught out by it? And ultimately, I think one of the best mindsets of stewardship as a leader is to make the choice, come what may, we have to step into bolder innovation, and we have to figure out how do we organize so that the right level of incremental and transformational innovation can show up, even though it scares us witless. We're going to do it anyway, you know?
Right. I love the colorful language and the almost visceral metaphors. Like, you can actually feel what you were thinking about as you were writing it. So I love it. And it also makes the book a lot more accessible and approachable and really, you know, just fun to read. But you talk about bold ideas, and to me, that suggests risk. And whenever there's risk involved, I think about company culture, right? I think about what is the right culture that would enable us to kind of overcome this risk and take bolder steps. So you have a whole chapter in the book that talks about culture, but it seems like it's sort of this recurring thread throughout the book. I want to know, in your experience as you're writing this, what separates companies that truly manage to build an innovation culture from those that don't?
It's an interesting observation you just make about culture, because I got to the section on culture and thought, everything I'm writing here is culture. Ultimately, a lot of it boils down to the behaviors that are going to need to show up at every level here. So then when I came to write the chapters on it, I thought, what am I going to write here? So it was a really interesting point in the journey. But the difference that I saw was the companies that do it well, they're not binary about culture. So there was a philosopher back in the 1960s who described culture as what is ordinary. So the ways of thinking and working, you know, how we do things around here, lots of good definitions of culture. But this one of what is ordinary really stood out for me, because when you rewind and think about what it is that the executives are asking for, they are asking for extraordinary ideas, but they're hoping that they're going to emerge from an ordinary context. And left to their own devices, behaviors generally follow the path of least resistance. So trying to fit bold innovation in a business as usual or ordinary context is kind of living in fantasy world. It's not going to happen. So what I observed in, you know, great innovators or companies that were seeing more bold innovation come forward more readily were that they were very deliberate about culture and not leaving it to chance. And what they were doing was thinking about the outcome they needed from the innovation and calibrating the culture accordingly. So if you think about organizations like Google, I know they're a common example, but there's Google and there's Google. There's the mothership, Alphabet, and lines of business that have been running for a long time. And you won't see a lot of risk-taking and high stakes failure going on there, because they need to make money and that's not appropriate. So they have a type of culture there. Go to Google X, where you've got Astro Teller running this pirate ship. They openly celebrate 99% failure rates. Now, they have a very different culture in there, because they've calibrated it to know that if people are going to step forward, they've made the path of least resistance for bold ideas very straightforward. And, you know, lots has been written about how they do that. So for me, the breakthrough in my own understanding was you have to calibrate the culture to the outcome that you're pursuing. You can't have a one size fits all culture and expect all manner of innovation to show up. So this calibration is really, really important.
I want to touch on one specific notion that I found really interesting in the book, and I think it's one of the only places I came across this. I don't know if it's a term you coined, but you call it question design. I found that really interesting. Could you explain what it is and why you believe it matters so much?
Yeah, well, I need to tip a hat here to Hal Gregersen, who really got me on the path of questions. I read, I can't remember the name of the book, I'm embarrassed to say, but he wrote a book about questions, and it started me thinking about it more meaningfully. And I guess what I've discovered in my work, this is less in the research for the book now, is that what we do today limits what we can imagine for tomorrow. It becomes like status is like this corporate chloroform, and it dulls us into it dulls our imagination to be less able to imagine anything beyond what we do today. And you see it in brainstorms all the time. People are asked to dream big, and they find it really hard to think of very much beyond what happens today. It happens with customers as well. One of the worst things to do is to ask customers for the next big thing idea. They find it really hard. I'm sure you've seen this in your work as well. So this idea of, you know, think outside the box, sometimes it's hard to see the box because we don't even know it's around us. So the idea of, I call them catalytic questions, is questions that have been deliberately designed to do a couple of things. First is break through that status quo ceiling, which is above us and all around us. And that often just boils down to naming what we believe the rules of the game are in the situation. What allows the status quo to manifest? What are the assumptions that we hold? What are the dependencies that we believe have to be in place? We name them, and then we deliberately challenge them and mess with them to a certain degree. Because actually, once you've named them, you often just the process of naming them makes you think, well, why don't we do it like that? It's one of the reasons I love the business model canvas. And when I run a business model canvas session, often the biggest fruit which comes from it is the questions that people ask. Why are we doing it like that? Do we really have to do it this way? And it's breaking through the status quo, which is really important. They also do a second thing, which is they allow us to be very specific when it comes to idea generation. So rather than saying, how can we create more growth for this product, which often is the kind of question that comes up in a brainstorm, it's how can we create 10% more progress in this dimension of the product, or the progress that the customer is trying to make, how can we increase that by 10%, or how can we get a 10x return, and everything in between. We're calibrating the kind of outcome to the question, which we often don't do. And then we get frustrated with the ideas that are landing on the table. Well, we never calibrated the specific outcome or measure that we're going for. And then in the process of, so something that I encourage people to do is design questions in advance, and for the leader to count the cost of what those questions are. Because if you're really asking people for 10x ideas, you need to be ready to sponsor them. And sometimes leaders get caught out in the middle of a brainstorm, getting a carried away, and it dawns on them, oh my goodness, there's a lot of risk attached to this. I need to rein it in a bit. And then people are starting to get confused about, well, what qualifies as a good idea here? So I just find questions are a really healthy way to break through the status quo and help steer the kind of ideas that we really need the business to discover and develop.
So focus on asking better questions. Okay, so our time together is almost, it's coming to sort of to an end. I want to ask you one more question before we wrap up that I think, so we got to steer things up before we wrap up. I think this one is really going to resonate with our listeners because it's one of these, I feel, sort of rules, this bullshit rules that we have about how we do things in the innovation space. And this is something that, you know, I've given this advice a bunch of times. I'm sure many of our listeners have as well, which is, you know, during the creative process, we tell people not to fall in love with their ideas, right? But you, in the book, say exactly the opposite. Why?
Well, first of all, I agree with the sentiment of you shouldn't fall in love with your ideas, because we all know it. Love is blind, and we can't be objective about truth. And for me, one of the definitions around swirling around innovation is the pursuit of truth. We're looking for something that is going to work here at some point. And there'll be a mess along the way, but ultimately we're looking for truth. Now, I would say that when people are saying don't fall in love with your ideas, they're talking about people who are actually infatuated with ideas. And, you know, if anyone's fallen in love at teenage years or early 20s, there's something about falling in love in that stage of life where you really cannot think straight. Of course, it can happen at any stage of life, but particularly there. And I think that is really, that's not a healthy place to be. It's, you don't want that, but that's not love. I would say in most contexts, when you are trying to push an idea forward, you need passion about that idea to push it through. What is an organization that is doing everything it can to kill or water down your idea? And if you don't care enough, you're not going to make it through. I mean, why would you choose a life of pain? You've got to care enough. But the distinction I like to make is this. Most organizations that I meet, they have a dating attitude towards innovation. It's quite casual. It's a fling. We have a campaign here and there, but it's not an ongoing commitment like a marriage might be. And in marriage, true love is often a choice. It's not a feeling. We don't feel like doing it, but I've made a choice here that I'm going to love this person and I'm going to do the right thing. Love knows when to push forward and when to let go and looks for a bigger picture of what we're trying to do here. And ultimately, if we have a healthy view of what this idea is about, the feeling that we have towards it and the destination we're pursuing will be, okay, now's the right time to drop this. I've listened to a lot of advice here. I've got a lot of feedback. I should let go of this. So I think it's important to make that distinction between infatuation and love, because they are two different things. And if you've got people running around infatuated with their idea, absolutely, that's dangerous. But I think we're unwise to forget the humanity of innovation and how people do feel about something that they've conceived and they're passionate about pushing forward. I think the healthy thing to do is to help people frame it as love and not infatuation and understand what some of those dynamics might be. And one of those is maybe, you know, have someone with you who you respect, who can help you listen to truth, just in case that fog of infatuation is taking you down a wrong path by mistake.
Yeah. So passion, not infatuation. I think it brings, maybe perhaps sheds light on an innovation manager coming to their boss, you know, pitching a project, and their boss says, I've got a headache.
Oh, I love that. Not today, darling. I've got a headache.
Exactly. Not today. Maybe tomorrow, maybe next week. You know what? We said once a month. I love that. I love that. Let's give people, hopefully we've given people a bunch of reasons to go out and buy your book. Let's tell them where they can get the book, where they can learn more about Be Less Zombie.
So there is a website dedicated to the book, which is belesszombie.com. The book's on Amazon. It's on all of the main bookstores if you Google it. So you'll find that very easily. If you go to elvinturner.com, you'll also find the course that I've created that's free that goes with the book. That's going to be up there for the duration of COVID. And I don't know when that really ends, but it's a gesture just to help people. But it's there for now. So go and grab it while you can, because it won't be up there for free forever.
Absolutely. I highly recommend it. I've seen all the movies from the course. It's absolutely great. You should definitely go and check it out. Elvin, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Yaniv. It's been a pleasure.